Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
So I'm Josh.
I'm Sophie.
And we are back again to talk about Vegetarian Vampires, our third and hopefully final episode in this limited run series. And we got up to around the year 2000 last time, I think. So we are doing 2000 and everything after, which is code for Twilight. We're going to be talking about Twilight. This is Sophie. You're going to really come into your own on this episode, I hope, and take us through all these TV shows
and
supernatural romances that I haven't talked about. Do you prefer supernatural romance or paranormal romance?
Paranormal romance.
Paranormal. Is there a difference?
I know there's a difference between paranormal and supernatural. I think, I don't know what it is, but like, I don't have a scholarly definition to go on. Paranormal means like somehow grounded in reality.
So
and then
I put
supernatural
it to you,
is magical, I think.
Yeah, but vampires are magical, right?
No, because they're undead.
Right,
so they're
which is definitely
like
not
human.
Magic.
So they're not like a wizard.
Wizards are human. Wizards are more human than vampires.
Paranormal specialist. I just like the term paranormal.
I put it to you then. Is the show Supernatural a paranormal romance? Or a paranormal bromance, more like it?
Oh, I couldn't say because I haven't watched it, but it seems to just be a bros show.
We are going to have to watch the Vegetarian Vampire episode, though.
The show scares me. I don't want to watch it.
Because of all the vampires.
It's just, I find it really scary. But I'll watch it for Sam and Dean because they are hot.
Yeah, more like paranormal hunk.
They are a paranormal hunk.
I mean, they're not the paranormal part, or are they? I've never seen a full episode of this show. I've seen like bits and pieces in passing, but since I've brought it up, let's point out the 2006 Supernatural episode Bloodlust, which involves a group of vampires who feed on cows to avoid notice from hunters. I'm reading this direct off TV Tropes, the worst website on the internet. So I haven't seen this episode, but the description they have there, yeah, no, that's it. Apparently it's an episode of Supernatural where there are vampires who raise cows, but I will watch that and it will be in the book/article. So that is an example of the cutting analysis you're going to be getting from the rest of this episode. But let's rewind, because that's 2006. Let's rewind back to the start of the 2000s. And yes, as I said, we're going to get to Twilight and then essentially this episode is going to be in your hands, Sophie. But there are two pre-Twilight things that I want to mention. The first being I'm not quite sure what to call it, because it's not old enough for young adult. I think that implies like an older teen audience.
Young adult's pretty much 12 to 18, but it's usually 12 to 16. Yeah.
But if I say young adult book, you're thinking Twilight and stuff, and this isn't that.
Mm-hmm.
But children's novel is too young. It's far more advanced and more not mature, but has more grown up subjects in it than mm-hmm. Children. So maybe the young readers series, the Darren Shan series is what I'm talking about. Darren Shan.
Pick your title.
I'm going with Darren Shan because it rhymes with Darren, right? Darren Shannon. Darren Shan.
That does not rhyme.
Shan.
No.
Anyway. Whatever, that's what I'm calling it. Darren Shan series, the first book of which came out in 2000. Now, Sector Freak is the name of the first book, although most people will know this from its film adaptation, which was called The Vampire's Assistant, with, what's his name, John C. Reilly played the vampire in that. The Vampire's Assistant is actually the name of the second book in the series. So this is actually a series that when I was around 13, 14, I think I got a copy of it for a friend for his birthday. And then we got into it. We liked it. So this is about like a young boy who he doesn't become a vampire, or he does. He's like a half vampire. And then there's different things. It's a whole thing. But it's like the premise of the novel is the series is a kid. He goes to a freak show, and one of the freaks is a vampire. And then he tries to steal the dude's spider, the vampire's spider. And then the vampire vampires him and makes him be his assistant. And then he becomes like a vampire prince and things. Anyway, but The Vampire's Assistant, which is the second book of like the first trilogy. This series is broken up to like four different trilogies that sort of tell these different story arcs. And The Vampire Assistant is essentially a not, I was going to say a treatise, but it's not like a statement. It's like a meditation, a debate about vegetarian vampirism, which again predates Twilight by, I think, 4 years, 4 or 5 years.
I don't know, but I'm looking at the guy's Instagram and he's now the councilman of Ward 3 for Blaine, Minnesota.
What does that mean?
So it's just I think he's a councilman for maybe a suburb in
Right.
Minnesota.
Oh, okay, right.
So clearly the vampire assistant didn't kick his career off into
Oh, well, I think it
national
did.
movie stardom.
The movie flopped, but I think these books were extremely popular and he's made a whole career off them. So maybe he's just doing that to do it, or because he has time to, because he can rest on his book lovers.
Well,
'Cause yeah,
no,
I think.
it's the actor who played Darren Shan.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the author.
No, so the actor Darren Shan now loves Jesus, his wife, and Minnesota, according to his Instagram bio.
You know, that movie flopped hard and he was not good in it, and I've never seen him in anything else, so that fully checks out. But the books themselves were quite popular, I believe. Now, I've got to remember this book because now it's been like a year since I reread the whole series recently, and they're pretty, yeah, I reread the whole series recently on my vampire kick, and they're pretty rough. Like some of the childish writing style and jumps in logic are, yeah, like there's a whole book where he goes back to school for no reason. Again, pre-Twilight, but it's like a vampire in primary school because he's trying to outwit. I don't know. It's bad. It's very, very bad. But there are some really interesting ideas in this book. Like it ends up going into like dimension hopping wizard stuff in the last trilogy that goes like between the future and things and about how vampires can populate the world and stuff. So there's some interesting ideas, including, yes, this deeper engagement with the ethics of eating and things. Because the primary tension or conflict in the book is there are two different types of vampire, two different, yeah, I guess they're types rather than tribes, but there are what we know as vampires. And then there are the Vampanese, which that's got all kinds of xenophobic connotations to it. But I think he just came up with the word and was like, yeah, that works. The Vampanese, who are like, and the difference between these two, like, again, yeah, I don't know if they're species or if it's an ideological thing or if it's a biological thing, but I think it's an ideological thing that became a biological thing, because the key ideological difference is vampires don't kill when they feed, and Vampanese do. Now, conversely, the Vampanese are like these massive purple-skinned, like monster dudes with claws and red eyes and stuff. So, like the feeding on blood is physically changing them and physically empowering them as well. And there are debates later in the book about like, well, if they need the blood physically, like then we can't have ethical problems with it, right? It's like hunting. It goes into that later in the series. But this second book, The Vampire's Assistant. I think this is before the Vampanese are introduced. I think they're introduced in the third book. In this book, this is just about the kid. He's faked his own death. He's working as the vampire's assistant in the circus, and it's just like he's hanging out in the town, right? Where he and his best friend, the snake boy, he's not an F boy, he's an S boy. I think his name is Ezra. No, Evra, not Ezra. I might be making all of this up because I'm doing it off memory. There's a kid from the town that like comes snooping around the circus, and they befriend him, and they're like living in a tent or something like in nearby, and they're like sort of hippie, bohemian hippie, what's the word, transients is the word, who are vegetarians, one of whom is named RV. He's Reggie Veggie is his name.
Reggie Veggie.
Reggie Veggie. And they have debates about like animal ethics and the ethics of eating when they find out he is a vampire. Because yeah, I think there's cattle is going missing in the surrounding like areas because the vampires have moved in. They've been feeding on the cattle, and then these like vegetarian animal activists are here, and they're like, all this cattle have gone missing, and we're like onto it. And then, you know, they're like, oh, but we're vampires actually, and it's us who have been eating the cattle. But then it turns out it's actually the Vampanese or some shit. But they have debates about all this, and it's like, oh, because the other thing that's going on in the book is this is the kid, Darren Shan. He has been turned into a vampire or a half vampire. It's like there's two stages. You get half-blooded, which they don't do by eating, they do by like they cut holes in the or slits in the end of the fingers and they put their hands together and the blood like transfuses. So he has been made into a half vampire, and then later on he will be made into a full vampire, right? But he has been made into a half vampire who has half the powers, half the ages at half the rate, all of that stuff. But having become a half vampire, the first half of the book before they meet Reggie Veggie and everything is him refusing to drink human blood. Like this is a very interview with the vampire Lestat and Louis thing where he won't do it and he like starves himself. And I think he even refuses to feed on animal blood, or he tries to get by on rats. But much like with Interview with the Vampire, he ends up giving in. He's like, this is unhealthy. I can't live like this. and then gives in and starts drinking human blood. But the whole like first half of the book is just them having debates about whether it's okay to eat people or animals and all of that, right? Then they shack up with a vegetarian animal activist whose name is Reggie Veggie, and
Who's
then
a
this
human?
who's a human? Well, so once Darren accepts that, you know, he has to eat, he has to drink human blood, then of course you get the introduction of the Vampanese to say, well, he drinks human blood, but he doesn't kill, unlike this next level of monstrous creature, right? Reggie Veggie at the end of the book, that he comes into conflict or something, and he gets his arms chopped off. I can't remember by who, but he does, and he runs away and he swears vengeance on him. Like 5 or 6 books later, there is an evil Vampanese with hook arms, and it is Reggie Veggie. He is now like the Vampanese lieutenant and has like gone from animal activist veggie hippie man to like crazy violent hook-handed Vampanese dude who again has these debates about like, well, now it's just a biological thing, I don't have to grapple with it because now I need blood and I embraced it and all this, which is like kind of really interesting as a turn, but also plays into this phenomenon that I'm tracking in the books and things, where the only representation of animal activists in, I'm primarily looking at science fiction, but it seems like fantasy as well, is as villainous. And here we have like one a vegetarian human being turned specifically into a monstrous meat-eating or blood-drinking vampire, and in both cases he is presented as, so like the theme I'm tracking in the science fiction book is human carnism, human meat-eating, especially English human meat-eating, is always presented as like a sensible middle ground between vegetarianism, which is like restrictive, repressive, nonsensical, irrational chase, and like monstrous cannibalism and things like that. And so here you have it again, where the vampires who drinks human blood but doesn't kill is presented as the sensible middle ground between Reggie Veggie, who as a human was this ridiculous hippie man who cared about animals more than people, and then this monstrous blood drinking Vampanese. So I think I have a whole article in me about this book and this series, or some kind of a conference paper or something, but there's a lot going on there for what is a terribly written children's series. This is, along with Discworld, I think, like a direct, like, not only do we have a whole book in the series that is engaging with animal ethics and vegetarian vampirism, but it is the most popular and prominent of these books. So I think that is a notable book that doesn't really get looked at or brought up enough. The second thing I want to talk about, unless you had anything more to talk about there.
Nope, go for it.
The second book I wanted to talk about before we get into Twilight and everything else is my favorite vampire book, I think, which is Octavia E. Butler's Fledgling from 2005. Like, I think in Interview with a Vampire, if you're asking me like objectively what is the best, most important vampire book, it's that one. But the one I like the most is Fledgling by Octavia Butler. Who, do you know who Octavia Butler is?
It's on my list of books to read
Right.
because it seems like one of the more influential. Everyone will cite
Oh, really?
fledgling.
I
Yeah,
haven't seen
everyone
too many
always makes
citations
reference
of
to
it.
fledgling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't come across too much of it. I was reading this morning because I'm about to have to write about her, because she does a lot of stuff with vegetarian things and apparently became a vegan or a vegetarian at the end of her life because of health reasons. But then is one of my main figures in my history of science fiction that reinforces hunting as the proper way and natural way for humans to live. So a bit of a weird conflict
Interesting.
there. But I was looking through, I think it's from 2016, just a book. I think it's just called Octavia Butler. That came out recently by that's a biography and analysis of all her works by Jerry Canavan, who, but I was going through, yeah, his book this morning for a couple of things, and noticed that he mentions Fledgling and says that this was Octavia Butler's last book, and she wrote that she hated it and she didn't want it released into the world and she was embarrassed by it. And as I've said, it's my favorite vampire book, I think. I think it's my favorite of just her books. And also, I am currently reading at the moment her book Survivor, which is like the third in a series. I think it's the first book she wrote, but the third book she published, which she has also disowned. I'm not really sure why, but this is, it's disowned. It's not republished in when you get omnibus versions of the series. It's from the Patent Master series. This book is excluded from it. It hasn't been reprinted since like the 80s or something. She hates it, embarrassed by it. I am almost finished. I've got like 50 pages left. I think it's brilliant. I really like it. It's really interesting. So whatever Octavia Butler doesn't like about her own writing, I really like. But I don't know, we're on different pages. Anyway, as I say, Fledgling, it's a vampire book. It's a very complex and weird vampire book. I think they're aliens, and they have a whole council, and they control people with their saliva and their telekinetic empaths, and they do all this stuff. So really complex and interesting, really troubling, as with a lot of Butler's work. Every protagonist of Butler's novels is a woman who falls in love with an underage woman who falls in love with an abusive, extremely older man. That is how Octavia Butler's, like, I think every single one in all of her books is this person. Fledgling is a child vampire. It's doing the thing where she's like 50 years old, but she appears 12. But the opening scene of Fledgling is she, I wanted to say possesses, but she finds a trucker man who is like a pedophile and seduces him and is controlling him. So there's a little bit of, and then he becomes like the sympathetic human character. So there's the stuff going on there. She also she and then she goes around collecting people by seducing him with her young child body and also possessive saliva. So there's a lot to grapple with there, which is an interesting take on the vampire thing, like turning the victim of pedophilia into the controller and all of that. Which would maybe be less troubling if she literally didn't do this in every single one of her books. Seems like, yes, less a engagement with the vampire trope than an expression of something she has been trying to deal with a lot. So don't know what's going on there. That is to say that as much as it's my favorite vampire book, let's not go into this being warned. There's a lot of stuff going on there. They are not vegetarian vampires. Quite frankly, they are carnivorous vampires. They eat food, and they specifically have to eat raw meat, like, to heal themselves. Like, yeah, she's at the start of the book. Her family's been like massacred and things, and she's left. What's the word? Destitute or diminished, I guess. And then she has to hunt and find raw meat to eat to heal herself back up to, full health and full powers. But then outside of that, they feed on quote unquote willing humans who become part of their family, right? It's sort of this utopian book where they're establishing this interspecies community where she's going around and finding these humans who are like misfits in society and saying, well, hey, come and live with me. One of whom is an old dying woman, an old dying black woman who is very clearly Octavia Butler, and is saying, oh, hey, come. Come live in my commune where I will, my vampire stuff will like preserve your life forever. And in exchange, I will feed from you, but I won't kill you. And feeding feels really good. Like this is an orgasmic feeding sort of thing. The problem with all of that is the saliva, the healing saliva and everything, it's completely controlling. So it's like how much of this is willing and how much of it is her like brainwashing these people. I mean, the section in Jerry's book that I was reading this morning, he talks about it as this guy, he didn't have latent pedophilic tendencies or anything, or he wasn't a pedophile. She put them in him with her saliva and her brainwashing. My read on it is he had the tendencies and was a pedophile, and she took advantage of that. But yeah, so this is when we're talking about interspecies harmony and interspecies relationships, this seems to provide a good model, but it is like deeply like troubling and complex. And all of that is made extra interesting where, yeah, this was her last book. I think she published it, either she died that year or the year after, I think. Which is why I think she's the dying woman in the book. But this was when she was a vegan. She wrote this book, like vegetarianism and animal stuff has been like all through her series, but this is the one she wrote when she had converted to vegetarianism. Again, I haven't tracked that down. It's been mentioned by a lot of secondhand sources. I can't really find any like solid record of like why she did it or what the deal with Butler's vegetarianism is. I'm in the process of tracking that down. But this was the one book she wrote as a vegetarian author, and it is a book about interspecies utopianism, maybe, but also we require raw meat to sustain ourselves. So, an interesting engagement with the vegetarian vampire trope there. So those are the two I wanted to get out of the way in the early half of the 21st century. But none of that matters because that same year in 2005, along comes Stephenie Meyer with her some book called Twilight, and apparently she invented vampires or something. That seems to be how people receive this book.
So Twilight was huge. I think the only comparison for the amount of hysteria over this novel could possibly be met with, I think, Harry Potter. I remember distinctly the mania around Harry Potter
They're
when
definitely
it came out.
comparable, and I think that the one difference is like Harry Potter is credible in a weird way. Like no one was ironically liking Harry Potter. People were just like, yes, we like Harry Potter. Twilight was sort of phenomenal in spite of itself. Like, there are people who like Twilight, and then there was everyone else who thought it was ridiculous, but knew what it was and knew what Team Edward was and knew what Team Jacob was and all of that. Like, I don't think Harry Potter was looked down on in the same way that Twilight has come to represent, like, now.
No, but regardless of it being dismissed, Harry Potter, Twilight, and The Hunger Games were the three big young adult series of that era. And my interest in Twilight and why I see Twilight as emblematic of this vegetarian vampire, and that's where, my research started, was with Twilight. What was I saying? Oh yeah,
Just Twilight itself.
because you had not necessarily when the books were released. So first Twilight came out in 2005, preceded every year thereafter with New Moon, Eclipse, and then finally Breaking Dawn in 2008. And then it was in December, if I'm either November or December 2008, was when the first movie adaptation was released, starring Kirsten Stewart and Robert Pattinson. And that is when I first clued onto Twilight. My earliest memory of the series was going to school in year eight, half an hour before class, and there was a line of maybe 10 or so of me and my girlfriends, and we'd sit and read communally the book together. And it's my only experience of communal reading in that regard. And it's just such a core memory. But you had at this time, and this is again where my thesis thinking began, this weird 2 year period where the vegetarian vampire was everywhere. It was like the zeitgeist of the time. You had the movie adaptation of Twilight. I think 3 or 4 months prior, you had the first series of True Blood, or the first season of True Blood was released. And we'll speak about that in a little bit. And then in March of, well, I should say September 2009, we then had the first series of Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, this set the like paradigm of what vampires are, how vampires work, these like teen paranormal romance things that is still going on. Like, we were just talking about how this month there's been the adaptation of the Vampire Diaries. Like, this is
Vampire
still,
Academy.
like, yes, thank you, Vampire Academy. This is still the current paradigm we're in, and it's people trying to recapture, redo Twilight, build on that. Like, as much as I begrudge it, I know you love Twilight and I do not.
It is my favorite vampire novel for all of its
It is my
astounding problems and issues.
Yep.
I still love it.
Well, I mean, I was just talking about how mine's about a seductive pedophile vampire, so we're on equal ground there. But for all of that, and for all it's been dismissed by, a lot of people, like, it's the big one.
It is the big one.
It's yeah, I think yeah, Dracula is the only vampire book that is more influential than it. As much as I want to say
Interview with
into
the Vampire, I'd throw in. I would say our key texts would be Dracula, Interview with the Vampire, and Twilight in
I
each
mean,
of the different
yes, they
centuries.
are the three like
They're the big three.
paradigm shifting books where that comes out and that's what vampires are now until the next one comes along. And Vampire, I would actually argue that Interview with a Vampire is more influential than Dracula on account of what modern vampires are now has
I
more to do
agree.
with that
I
than
agree.
Dracula. But in terms of like public and popular prominence and awareness, no one knows what Interview with a Vampire is now, even though everything they watch is just redoing it is because of it. It's Interview with the Vampire is for vampire fans nowadays, whereas Dracula and Twilight are these pop culture phenomenons that Interview with the
They're
Vampire was
cult
in the
texts.
70s, where like people know who Edward is. So yeah, as much as I begrudge it and I don't really see the merit in it itself, and I'm a little bit baffled by, like, because it wasn't the first one. We talked about how Vampire
No.
Diaries, the book, came out 10 years before or whatever, and we're going to talk about how the True Blood books, the Southern Vampire Mysteries, they came out earlier as well, and they're still very flawed and very of a time, but I think they're much better and much more interesting as works itself. But for whatever reason, Twilight is the one. And I don't know if I'm retroactively remembering this, but I'm pretty sure I was aware of Twilight before the movie came out. Like, the movie's what blew it up, but I was aware of Twilight and what Twilight was in the lead up to that. Like, it wasn't the movie that broke it. The books were huge, and then they made movies out of it and made it huger. And there hasn't been anything since. Like, we are still in the Twilight vampire paradigm.
I would agree, except I did have to present TE9s the other day at university as part of like weirdly early open day, come see what university is like in year nine. I don't know any year nines that would be
Yeah, that's
willing to
weird.
go there. But I did have a moment of thinking in the shower where where all my great thinking occurs, that shit, these year nine students may not know what Twilight is.
Did they
And when I
though?
was presenting to them, there was no real, usually when, I introduce myself to my class and I say that, my thesis is in Twilight, you get met with two reactions. One reaction is like excited clapping and questions, and usually all the girls in my class get all up in a dizzy about it, which I love. And then the other half of the class groans either because, and I'm not trying to be sexist here, but it's usually guys being like, oh,
Yeah.
or girls who are very, I should say women, because they're post teenagers now, adults, very aware of how problematic certain aspects of the text are. So it's always kind of, I'm met by these two responses. But the year nines didn't seem to be aware of it. I think we're now potentially in a post-Twilight culture, at least in terms of readers coming to the test.
Has something replaced it though?
Not that I'm aware
TikTok,
of.
right?
Yeah,
We
probably
could do an
TikTok.
article on TikTok vampires.
We could. I know a TikTok educator who's a PhD at Uni Melb, Esme James. Check her out. And she publishes her research on TikTok, some of it, and she's become huge. So
Do I
maybe
know her?
there's a space for TikTok for us. But I did hear from one of my students that there has been like a Twilight renaissance on TikTok due because we're, God, I know, 20 years since, nearly 20 years since it was first published. That makes me feel old. But yes, Twilight.
And that is all us to explain what Twilight is, which, if you're listening
Yes.
to this, you probably know, but that is
Yes.
its significance within the popular and academic
It is.
spheres. But why, tell us about the vegetarian vampire aspect in Twilight, because we've said this is where the term gets codified, where it gets popularized. The Cullens say, hey, we don't drink humans, we only feed on animals, we're vegetarian vampires. That's what's happening. What's it all about though, Sophie, as someone who's written an entire book or book chapter and
Yes.
thesis based on this? What's going on there?
Well, just for those of you who may not have read Twilight, it's essentially all the saga. And when I say Twilight, I'm using it to refer to the whole saga, not just the first novel. But it essentially follows the story between our human protagonist, Bella, who is later becomes a vampire, and her boyfriend, Edward, who is a vampire. And another spoiler alert, he also becomes her husband in later novels. Already, that should be signaling to readers a very kind of drastic shift that this text does with human vampire relations. In previous vampire series that we've discussed, I'm thinking here of Buffy, I'm thinking here of Anita Blake. I'm not sure if there's any human vampire interactions in any other text apart from maybe Fledgling.
Well, the Southern Vampire Mysteries.
Yes, which we haven't discussed yet.
But the book did come out.
But the book, yes. So the
Yeah.
Southern Vampire Mysteries, which comes out in 2001, you also get human vampire relationships. But Twilight kind of breaks the mold in that humans and vampires engage in romantic relationships, or at least Edward and Bella do, and they end up getting married. So you have this happily ever after, very heteronormative, also patriarchal
Mormon.
narrative, Mormon morality of, no sex before marriage and enshrining the woman in her proper place as a mother and wife, alongside vampires. But yes, so in this novel, Edward's family are self-proclaimed vegetarians. And as I noted in the introduction, they use this term as a joke. It's very tongue-in-cheek in the novel. They are
Like the
well
quote is, he
aware.
says, that's our little joke. So
Yeah,
it's not
it's
that
a
you're
family
reading
joke,
it
quote
ironically. He
unquote.
states, this is a joke.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I take it as a serious label. It's
Okay.
in the novel a joke, but what is interesting is that it picks up that use of the term in Anita Blake Vampire Hunter, where we first have the use of the term vegetarian to refer to a vampire who feeds on animal blood. And as Josh said, Twilight popularizes it. Now, in the world of Twilight, diet is integral. Josh has already spoken about in Darren Shan that you have two types of vampires or different factions of vampires. And again, they're separated or differentiated by their feeding habits. And this seems to be a recurring theme in any vampire text, which features a vegetarian vampire. We've seen this in Interview with the Vampire. We've seen this in Buffy. We see this in Anita Blake. And we also see this again in Twilight. The key difference in Twilight is that not only does vampiric diet separate the two kinds of vampires, it's morally encoded. So the Cullens who feed on animal blood are good vampires, and the novel makes this quite clear, and they have gold eyes. So their dietary difference is registered in their physical body. Not unlike, and we spoke about this with Discworld, how the reformed vampires wear their black ribbon. Interestingly, Maya claims that she's never read a piece of vampire fiction before, but she does so much in this novel that you think to yourself, come on, like you must
Also,
have read a
she's
lot
an
before.
adult lady who lives in the
Yes.
world. Like,
Yes.
she's come across Dracula. It's happened.
Her argument is that as a Mormon, all these books were very naughty to read, so they weren't in the Mormon library. But again, the internet. So I see you, Maya, and I doubt your truth there. The other thing with Twilight in terms of diet, apart from good and evil, is that they've adopted this diet because of their belief that by feeding this way and not imposing suffering on humans, they might save their souls. They might have a chance at salvation. That ideology, or that theological belief, is grounded in Edward's father, Carlyle, who was raised by a 15th century priest in his human life, and is deeply religious and
Which
holds these
book is this in?
deep convictions. This is revealed in, so the fact that Carlyle, is a priest, or the son of a priest, is revealed in Twilight, so in the first novel.
Okay, I don't remember. I've only read the first book. I've seen all the films, but I've only read the
Yes. And
first
then
book.
in New Moon, after Bella gets a paper cut on her birthday, and then Edward's vampire brother attempts to attack her and feed on her, and then it's all hell breaks loose. She's covered in cuts and shit, and Carlyle's stitching her up on her birthday, and then reveals to her that he believes in salvation, and that their diet is a means to absolve themselves from being vampires so they might have a shot at heaven.
But this is very interesting to me because when we're talking about this good and evil, like I was going to go on a rant about how, again, that is measured by how human do you behave. And the evidence for that is, like, when we're saying the Cullens are distinguished by their dietary habits from the other kind of vampires, like the thing that makes the Cullens outcast from the wider vampire community is their diet, but also they have taken up this diet because their aim is to fit in with human society. They are trying to pass as humans, which goes back to my whole thing about, well, what do? Humans feed on other animals, therefore we do that. And it actually, I think it reinforces the idea that animals are edible rather than challenging it. But so that is to say, they feed on animals because it's right. Why is it right? Because that's what humans do. It's all this subjective human thing. But you're saying there is this angle of, and again, it is human imparted morality, but that they are doing it not only to fit in, but also to save their souls. So is that just like what? Because then that stops being a human determined morality, and this is now perceived as a divinely determined morality. So what is the rationale there of why is eating people bad divinely and eating animals is okay? I mean, we can go off about biblical things about vegetarianism and stuff, but is it just that?
I think it's because they believe that, or if you're, if we're going along Protestant or Catholic thinking, murder's a sin. So feeding on humans is a sin, and being a vampire is evil. If you think, going back to Dracula, and that's, it's the alignment of vampires with Satan, and the use of, in Dracula, biblical iconography, you have the wafer, you have the cross, you have holy water. There's something else, but I'm missing it. And they're all used, or they're weaponized against the vampire. And that kind of ushers in this notion of Christianity or Catholicism at odds with vampires. And that's, it carries on so much into life. One of my old friends, whose mother is a practicing Catholic, I couldn't speak to her about my thesis because she was like, vampires are evil. They are Satan. And I was like, they're also fictional, but sure. If that, your belief, I'm obviously not going to force a discussion of vampires on you.
Did you tell her that
So
one's written by a Mormon, so it's okay?
yeah, and that's another interesting thing that Twilight does. It aligns vampires with God and Christianity, as opposed to being oppositional. You now have religious practicing vampires.
Who also turn out to be like super bad dudes, right? What are the Pope vampires that are in Italy?
Yeah, so they're not necessarily, so this notion of good and evil only, so in the novel it works along the lines of diet, but you don't have any notion of religion with the Volturi. They're not,
They just happen to be hanging out in the Vatican.
they're kind of the vampire legal authority. They're not, they're referred to as royalty. But there's also, and I know there's connections, obviously, royalty, their powers divined by God. And so there's really strong connections
Well,
between
they
church.
are like they're in Rome, right?
They're not in Rome,
Oh, I thought they were in
they're in
Rome.
somewhere in Italy, but
Yes,
it's
but
not Rome.
like that is, again, subtext. Like
Yeah.
this is aligning them with the Catholic Church. They are this like their real world analogy is they are the Vatican. They are the Vampire Vatican.
I've never thought of it that way, but you could read it that way.
Well, it's definitely how it's visually portrayed in the films, like when he goes into the room and like then they're sitting on the chairs and everything. The bit I want to pick up on that though is what you said way back at the start is that murder is a sin. So that is the divine thing. God said murder is a sin. And again, that is the distinction, but it's the species it's distinction that if you kill a human, it's murder. If you kill another animal, it is not. So again, another thing I would point to say this reinforces that species divide by reinforcing this idea of killable and non-killable murder and not murder. But yes, I think this is the angle you emphasize or take in your book. Yes, the
So beyond diet in Twilight, being a clear indicator of good and evil and the links to the salvation narrative, in my thesis now book, I also argue that there are distinct ecological imperatives that kind of underline the Cullen's diet. And there's a attention and attunement to the environment that you don't see in earlier works of vampire fiction. And I still stand by this claim.
I
So
think you're right.
in particular, or this kind of attention to the environment's first signaled by how the Cullens feed. When Edward's first explaining to Bella that, yes, I feed on animal blood, he notes that he feeds on deer and elk to begin with. And then we find out that, there's mountain lions and grizzly bears and other types of cute, fluffy creatures that become his meals. But as part of that conversation with Bella, he notes that his family choose to hunt in areas with an overpopulation of predator species, but that they also spread out as far as they need to in order to avoid over consuming deer and elk and local populations. So there's this very interesting, or at least I find it really interesting, there's a anxiety about how they're consuming, what they're consuming, and when they're consuming. The overpopulation of predators. So as Tara Carmichael argues in her chapter on ecophobia in Twilight, that their decision to focus their attention or their feeding habits in areas that have an overpopulation of predators is something akin to population control. So it's an effort to keep in, or to, I should say, to balance the ecosystem and maintain a balanced ecosystem. And Edward puts this desire in more certain terms when he tells Bella that he and his family, and I quote, "have to be careful not to impact the environment with injudicious hunting." So it's comments like that in Twilight that you get with their dietary habits that we don't see really in any other text.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to go check for it. I think some of this maybe comes into the Darren Shan stuff, but again, it's primarily focusing on the ethics of it rather than the environmental aspect. And this sounds like something that would have been brought up by Butler and Fledgling, but again, I can't point to what's going on there. And there have been other books that gesture towards like the problem of vampires and overpopulation, and that they feed on, like if everyone gets turned into a vampire, what do vampires eat? Like that's the dilemma of Daybreakers and things like that. But yeah, as far as like explicitly laying out the environmentalist issues of it, I do think that is a fairly original spin to Twilight, and what sets it apart from just the earlier stuff where it's like, well, I don't drink humans, so therefore I'm a good vampire. Like there is actual thought into like what are the ramifications of this, and that is again indicative of the times. For, 'cause this switches from like good eating to eating well, as Derrida would say, right? We can't be good eaters because we have to eat meat. I take issue with that, but if that is the premise, then if we're going to eat meat, what is the best way we can do it? And that is what a lot of 21st century environmentalist stuff is focused on. This is the idea of neocarnism, that it's not meat eating that's the problem. It's industrialized meat eating. I don't like any of this stuff, but that is what is being reflected in Twilight. But again, this still comes to me looking at it from a vegetarian perspective of just like essentially boiling down to it, saying we are eating animals for their own good, and I just don't like that. Not in Twilight, just as a general philosophy. And I don't know what the answer is, right? Like I don't know what the answer is to overpopulation without culling and eating things, but it just seems like sometimes this stuff is thrown out of, well, we just eat them. We're doing good by eating all the animals, and it's not interrogated further than that.
No, I'd say in Twilight, there's not a real consideration for animals, but there's a consideration for the ecosystem that they're a part of. So they're concerned with, again, the ecosystem system as a whole. And it's a interesting, there's no need for, Maya to add these thoughts into the novel,
Yes.
because there's already a very strong biblical use of vegetarianism as well in this novel. And again, Laurie Branch has made this argument in their article that Edward refers to himself and Bella and their relationship in biblical terms, that the lion fell in love with the lamb. And that's taken from, and I don't know what the passage is in the Bible, but
It's
it's a
in there.
prelapsarian fantasy that is a vegetarian fantasy also,
Well,
that
that's Percy Shelley's whole thing in
yeah,
Queenland.
there's
Yeah.
no longer predation between species, and that species can come together. And that's the other thing with Twilight that, again, Fledgling does. And if a guy called Framrod Meyer, I'll send you his article, Josh, you'll be really
Okay.
interested in it, looks at Fledgling and Twilight as, and this is my other interest in Twilight, as post-human texts that usher in a fantasy of an interspecies cosmopolitanism. And that's his big word there. Insofar as Twilight, quite radically, I would argue, but also it's a colonialist fantasy and it's highly problematic, pictures or imagines this world in which vampires and werewolves and humans can live together and create their own interspecies community that's bound by love and care and protection as opposed to hatred or distrust. And you see that in Edward and Bella bringing together human and vampire, but in Edward and Bella's child, and again, here's some pedophilia for you, and so they're half human, half vampire baby who Jacob
Yeah.
imprints on. So imprinting is a
Adult werewolf.
biological incentive or imperative in this world where, you fall in love with one true love. You fall in love at first sight and you become, and Jacob does defend himself against claims of pedophilia by saying, it's the type of selfless love where you be whatever they need you to be. That could be a protector, a best friend, or a, lover later in life. And the insinuation is that it'll be later in life. But their love, given that he's part of the werewolf faction, brings them all together. But as many critics have said, and while I looked at it in my thesis in my book as a kind of interspecies utopia that takes the steps forward in making kin, as Donna Haraway says, or making kin, I should say, that the way forward in an era of ecological disaster is to form bonds of kinship with dirt, rocks, other species, and other peoples. It's also a white colonialist fantasy where you have the white, overly sparkly white vampires civilizing the savage werewolf beasts that also in this novel are American or Native American. So you've got a admixture, a very problematic admixture of Native Americans as werewolves.
Which
And
also
then
ties into the neo-Carnist stuff in that normally that predominantly comes from idealizations of Native American like hunter-gathering. So that is that all of this is coming together in Twilight. And I think that interspecies cosmopolitanism is really interesting. But where it grates against me is it's only humanoid species that are part of the community. Werewolves and vampires can pass as humans. They're the ones welcomed in. It's not like the werewolves are sort of half animal, half human. They're like, and they're presented in this weird, like, we're the Native American protectors of nature. But again, there's no actual consideration for the non-human animals themselves.
No, and I don't think there is in any of these vampire texts on my list.
Because if we think about like the ecological thing of the vampires like maintaining the environment by culling animals and overpopulation, and maybe this is a bit, like it has to have been done in another vampire book, but why aren't the vampires killing the humans and culling their population? Because again, there's still a divide. They can't do that. That would be morally wrong. That would be murder. That's where that idealization comes into it. So the only way they can do it is by culling the non-human populations. But again, this is like it's anthropomorphic. What is good is what the environment good for humans. So it's very complicated, and I think it's more complicated than she just made a joke about vegetarians and moved on. Like there's something going on here. But yeah, I don't know. There's something I think it reinforces these species divides rather than really challenging them. That's my read on it.
I think you're right to a certain extent, but I also think that if you read the text as an analogy and its points about, overcoming ingrained species or speciesism, I'm going to throw in there in terms of vampires and werewolves, as well as humans and vampires, that it does provide a model of living and being in this world. That, again, as an analogy and rooted in the use of the text term of vegetarianism, could be seen as suggesting that a vegetarian model is the way forward in creating an interspecies community where we value non-human animals. Although that's almost like completely, it is completely, not there in the novel, but if you're applying it as an analogy, then we have a model for caring about the world.
I don't think you can apply it as an analogy, though, when their model of vegetarianism is promoting culling them and feeding on them as an environmental good. Because if you shift the analogy to go, what if we're talking about humans eating plants? The analogy no longer holds because we're not talking about maintaining the environment by only eating certain kinds of overpopulous plants. Like, that's not a thing that comes up. So I don't know if the analogy holds. And I also don't know if, like, if we are going to treat it as an analogy, I don't know if. I get, yeah, okay, so the humans are the non-human animals. But then it would be saying we need to marry
Not necessarily.
non-human. Like,
Again,
it doesn't line up.
I think it's being too literal there in the application of it all. I think it's just, and it's looking at, so we're here considering vampires as a different species to human. It's a predator-prey relationship, and we share that with animals. Humans are vampires insofar as we feed on the bodies of others to sustain us. Those bodies of others are animals. We can argue this as the cows come home,
Well, I don't know. The only
but I
reason I
think
was
we
being
need to
so
move on.
literal with it is that, like, analogy implies that you have to. And I think the moment you start treating it as an analogy, it breaks down. What it is useful is, like, if it is provocative, it is asking you to reflect on these things, which you and a lot of other people have taken to, like, provoke a greater species bond, species relationship. But I think what's actually in the text is, like Stephanie Meyer's position is reinforcing these species hierarchies. But it is interesting that a book that to me seems so blatantly to just treat humans, non-human animals as disposable and irrelevant almost, has provoked within vampire scholarship and vegan scholarship these big reflections on interspecies relationships. Yeah.
Cute.
So yes, that is Twilight, and that was a huge pop culture phenomenon. So of course, that led to a lot of people trying to recapture that by making all the vampire romance books that had come out into similar movies and things. So Sophie, why don't you tell us about some of those?
So, one of, and I would argue, the clearest or most influenced vampire that came after Twilight would have been the Vampire Diaries television adaptation, which ran from 2009 until 2017, although it really should have stopped at least 4 years sooner because those final seasons are just shy. But yes, was the Vampire Diaries, which was adapted and executively produced by Kevin Williamson of Dawson's Creek fame and Julie Plec, who is also the executive producer of Vampire Academy, which we'll get to later in the piece. Now, we spoke about L.J. Smith's source text last week. So, a refresher, her Vampire Diaries novels were released between 1991 and 1993. And then, since then, they've had a bit of a resurgence post the television adaptation. We ended up with, I think, three more trilogies that were largely ghostwritten. They're novels from Stefan's perspective, and they're auxiliary to the novel or the saga as a whole. So for those reasons, I'm leaving them out of discussion today. But the television adaptation makes some humongous shifts in its depiction of the relationship between Elena, Stefan, and Damon. That's really at the center of L.J. Smith's text. In the TV series, Stefan is a more sure vegetarian vampire. You might remember last week I spoke about how in the novels, Stefan's kind of a quasi-vegetarian vampire, tries to feed on animal blood, but for instance, will snack on the football team in order to gain strength to fight his brother in a showdown. And he also makes other lapses throughout the series. In the TV series, he is quite staunchly vegetarian. He attempts to persuade newly turned vampires like Vicky and later Caroline into his way of feeding because he believes that vampires can choose the type of creature they want to be. And you can choose to be good and moral by feeding on animals and not humans because, as Stefan says to Damon, and I quote, they are people, not food. Damon disagrees, and for the majority of the series, he continues to feed on humans because he believes, and he says to Elena, we're predators, not puppies. We feed on human blood. We drink human blood. You can't malign us for that element of our being. Stefan, also TV series, and again, to show you how more kind of dietary centric this series is, turns Stefan into a ripper. A ripper in the Vampire Diaries mythology is a vampire that cannot control their bloodlust. And the only other example of this that I've come across is in Discovery of Witches, in which Matthew Claremont also has this ripper virus in his bloodline, and any vampires that he begets become mindless, bloodless killers, which is something, again, that I'll get to later in the piece. But in the Vampire Diaries, Stefan's status as a ripper is another kind of reason as to why he's a vegetarian. It's not just because he believes that humans are not food, and that by subsisting on a vegetarian diet makes you a good person. It's also because he cannot control himself when he drinks. It's an amazing episode. It's, I think, the first episode of season three where you discover that Stefan is a ripper, and Damon comes across this body, this bloodied body sitting on a couch, and he kicks its leg, and the head, the arms, and the torso all fall off the body. So Stefan, actually, you rip the body apart with blood frenzy. That's how hungry you are, and hence the term ripper. So that complicates Stefan's vegetarian diet, and it introduces a lot of ethical questions that you don't see in the novels. The other thing that the series does that's of interest to us looking at the vegetarian vampire is it introduces blood bags, so stolen IV blood bags taken from the hospital, as an ethical source or an alternative for vampires who don't want to feed on animal blood, but also don't want to feed on live humans due to moral or ethical qualms. A number of vampires in this series subsist on blood bags. Damon does from time to time. Other vampires like Pearl and Anna subsist on blood bags. Who else subsists on blood bags? Lexi, who is Stefan's vampire BFF, also subsists on blood bags. And the thinking is that, you're not harming human, you're not harming anyone by drinking freely donated blood. Again, that raises the question of, well, if you're depleting blood banks at hospitals, then humans that need blood transfusions are up ship creek because all the vampires have drunk the blood deposit. And as one examiner did tell me my thesis, that a diet of stolen IV blood bags would not pass a university ethics committee, which I thought was hilarious. So thank you, examiner out there, for having that comment. So yeah, there's a few different dietary alternatives in this series. And the other thing to note is that that kind of good vampire, bad vampire binary is still erected around feeding habits, but it's a little bit, there's more gray areas. So vampires who are evil in this series are vampires like Klaus, who's the first vampire from whom all other vampires have been created. But him being evil goes beyond feeding on human bloods. He also tortures humans. He manipulates them into, throwing themselves in front of buses and cars to traumatize people. He's very sadistic. So his evil kind of goes skin deep. It's not just his diet. So there's a lot of things that you can see that the television series does around diet that I would argue are due to a high, heavily influenced from Twilight and its focus on this vegetarian type of vampire. Because why else? Introduce things like blood bags, tweak Stefan's vegetarianism to make it a little bit more complex, whereas his diet's just quite lazy in the books, which is one of the reasons why I think the books are trash. But the other thing that Vampire Diaries does is there's a lot, again, of interspecies ethics. So you've got romantic pairings between humans and vampires, humans and werewolves, werewolves and vampires. That's a really cool one. And the difference is in this series, so in Twilight, in order for Edward and Bella to be together, she's turned into a vampire. But in this series, they allow Elena to stay human, and so she can continue being human while being with her vampire bae.
Right, that's interesting because we were talking about interspecies relationships, but like Bella is not an interspecies relationship. She is becomes a vampire.
Yeah, so she becomes a vampire. So it, and then in the novels, this is the other thing, Elena becomes a vampire
Oh,
in the
okay.
first novel, and then she becomes a ghost, phantom, spirit,
Thing.
ephemeral thing that floats in the sky and is a bit annoying. So again, the novel closes down that interest in interspecies ethics quite quickly because it becomes a vampire-vampire romance as
Right.
opposed to a human-vampire romance, which is what the TV series really explores.
Interesting. I don't have anything to add to that because I have not seen, I haven't, I don't think I've even seen a second of Vampire Diaries. I just know
It's
that it
so
exists.
good. It's very dark, both tonally and aesthetically. It's a really fantastic series. The soundtrack slaps. Elena's aunt dies and it's horrific. Like they just kill people off in this series. No one's safe, and it's just like you're hysterical the entire time. It's such a good watch. But they have, when Jenna dies and they have her funeral, there's Birdie's cover of Skinny Love, and it blew up after this series. When they're all just crying at the funeral, and my God, you've never felt so horrible in your life.
Oh, I haven't, because I
Yeah.
haven't seen it. Yeah, I guess the other difference there is you're saying this just sort of stops at I'm good because I don't eat people, right? Which plays into this, again, I'm gonna call them the beloved vampire trope, but the vampire boyfriend trope of just like, if you're gonna hang out with humans, part of this interspecies deal is you're not allowed to eat the people you're hanging out with. So if they want to pass and mingle with humans, then they have to forego that. Which is what all these fictions do. But as you pointed out, like Maya does take this further in Twilight by adding the environmentalist thing, by adding all of that stuff. Whereas here, like it's just that's where it begins and ends, right?
Yeah, the environmental element isn't quite present. There is a little quip that Damon makes to Stefan that says, but acknowledges the fact that, wouldn't a better diet be feeding on blood bags so then the bunnies don't come and gang up on you? But even then, it's kind of a joke. It's
Yeah.
not really taken up. There's no real interest in the environment here. But to quickly go back to something you said,
Yep.
it's slightly more than beloved here, given, and I didn't say this in Twilight, but in both Twilight and The Vampire Diaries, the vampire love interest also goes to extreme lengths to protect the human community from magical threats. So there's not
Right.
only an imperative, it's not only I'm good because I don't bite you, but it's also I'm good because I protect you from other vampires and magical threats. Like they go out of their way to keep saving the town.
That is an interesting pickup, yeah, because I mean obviously that carries through. I'm thinking of True Blood and stuff, although Sookie's sort of more active there as the defender of the vampires, which we'll get to. It's interesting because this is like sort of implicit in Interview of the Vampire, or not in Interview of the Vampire, but in the subsequent Vampire Chronicles. Like when they defeat the Queen of the Damned, they are stopping her from wiping out all the men on the planet. So they are protecting humans, but it's not like they're hanging out with a human. Oh, they do team up with the group, but that's a group of witches. So I guess they're sort of removed from humans. Like, yeah, they're not hanging out with humans and protecting their community. They're just doing their vampire shit that indirectly affects other people. But how does this play in then with the Slayer tropes? Because obviously Angel and Spike and Anita Blake, she's not the vampire, but the vampire and Anita Blake are protecting the human community. And I'm thinking, like, Vampire Hunter D, his thing is every book he goes to a new town and the town employ him to protect them from a supernatural threat. So is that a holdover from that?
Potentially. So vampires are like the human world's not aware of the existence of vampires or witches in this series. And vampire hunters
Right.
do come into the fold in the fifth season. And it's a really interesting take on it. The vampire hunters are positioned as the bad guys because they believe, and they're kind of bigot. They think that all vampires are evil and deserve to be raised. And like they threaten the livelihoods of the good vampires. So everyone kind of teams up to kill the vampire hunters because they're a threat.
Maybe in like pinning down this beloved terminology, maybe they are also the beloving vampires, right? In that they are beloved of humans, but they also love and protect
They
humans. I
love
think that is
humans, they
an
care for
important part
them.
of the trope. Still, the Slayer thing, the Slayer, how does that work?
The
I'm not sure.
Slayer stops becoming prominent.
That's true.
Again, in the Southern Vampire Mysteries, you get not vampire slayers, but they're evangelist terrorists that try to kill vampires. But the key difference, and perhaps we start talking about this now, the key difference in the Southern Vampire Mysteries is that the differences between species takes on an overtly racial
Right.
lens. So it's kind of like bigotry and hysteria, racism, discrimination, as opposed to, people enshrined with otherworldly powers that exist to kill vampires. And I think and this is a whole nother book, but I would think and I would argue that vampire slayers become less common as the genre gets further into different iterations of the beloved vampire, because if they're no longer a threat if they can be
Well, they
beloved and
become
beloved.
vampires is the thing, which is interesting because I think it starts with Vampire Hunter D, who is half vampire, but they stop being humans who are slaying vampires and they become vampires who are slaying vampires, which comes through Buffy and Anita Blake and stuff as well, and
Well,
Blade.
Buffy doesn't become a vampire. Anita doesn't
No, but
become a
Angel does.
vampire.
She hangs out with Angel, who.
Yeah, and Angels, yeah, but then in Vampire Diaries, they're humans,
But even in things like in the
who are
first Blade
vampires.
movie, Blade has a human lover, and he's half human. But then we get to Underworld, and Selene is a full vampire who takes a human lover, becomes sympathetic to him, and starts fighting to defend the humans again from the werewolves, but also from her own thing. So there is like a merging of like human vampire slayers start becoming the bad guys because we are now aligned with the good vampires, and they are a
Yeah,
threat to them.
that
So,
it's a shift in positioning, and like if Fred Bodding's famous argument in, I think it's a postmodern gothic or whatever, that in post 9/11 contemporary culture and a postmodern culture, monsters are no longer others, the monsters are us. And so I think that shift in signification and positionality where we start aligning ourselves with the monsters, and it's the humans that become the real monsters and the threat, and that as Bodding argues, that's a hangover from postmodern culture where there's no such thing anymore as delineated good and evil.
I'm just playing around with this in my head, so like these are not formulated thoughts. But what you've struck on here is just how integrated the Slayer trope is with this like beloved thing, because Louis and Lestat don't have human lovers, right? They
No,
turn them
but that's
into
because Rice isn't interested in the human world. It's a very vampire-centric tale.
but they are sympathetic to humans, and they are and that, but they don't.
Lestat is not sympathetic to humans.
Yes,
Yes,
he is
maybe in the other
in the
novels,
sequels. That's the whole
but
point.
not in Interview with the Vampire. And that is the main one,
He becomes the savior and prince of humanity.
which is BS.
It's silly, but that just talking broadly about the trope, they are sympathetic to humans. They are Byronic, but they are separate from them, right?
Very
They don't have
separate.
they don't take human lovers, but Angel, whoever the dude in Anita Blake, and Vampire Hunter D all have human lovers. Like that is the moment they start defending us and integrating with us. They start. Interesting. Shall we get into True Blood and the Southern Vampire
Yes.
Mysteries?
The third of our big three 2000 vampire texts of sorts is True Blood. So the very highly erotic gothic television series made by Alan Ball that went from 2008 to 2014. It is bonkers.
This is true.
It's bonkers. I don't love it. I find it hard to watch because I don't like gore and a lot of violence. And this series is just oozing with all of the above. But our main interest here in this series is that True Blood imagines a America where vampires have come out of the closet, or come out of the coffin, I should say. That's the quote that's used in the book that it's adapted from. And they're campaigning now for vampire rights.
Yes.
So, unlike the other texts that we've looked up until this point, with the exception of, I would say, Anita Blake, Vampire Hunter, vampires are out of in the open. They're a part of the human world
Well,
in
Discworld.
and Discworld. In True Blood, this kind of emergence of vampires and their belonging in the human world owes to the creation of synthetic blood. In this series, the synthetic blood is called True Blood, which is where the series gets its title from. And the thinking is, or the political, the party line that is pushed by the American Vampire League, who are the vampire politicians campaigning for rights, is that since we can get our blood out of a bottle, we're no longer a threat to human society. Of course, in True Blood, and again, this is a key difference to other texts we've looked at, in True Blood, this is an absolute farce. Vampires, including Nan Flanagan, who's the spokes vampire for the American Vampire League, they're all munching on humans behind closed doors. This is both consensual. So in True Blood, a lot of vampires will bite on their and feed off their romantic partners. And it's due to the conflation of love and sex, but also eating and sex. It feels as good for the human as it does for the vampire, we're told. But I think it also owes to the fact that their decision to feed on synthetic blood in this series doesn't owe to any sort of moral, ethical consideration for human
Right, it's just a
rights
way for them to
or humankind. Yeah.
fit in.
It's purely a way for them not only to fit in, but to make money. It's pretty much a capitalist endeavor in the series. And it's interesting. It does a lot that you don't see in other texts. It kind of does the work, or is cynical, not unlike Josh, about how moral or ethical these kind of feeding arrangements are. It's kind of showing like, well, you're vampires, you're still feeding on, blood and people. You can't be both good and engage in these behaviors. But at the same time, it also shows humanity in the series to be just as vulgar and awful and monstrous as the vampires. You have Suki's uncle Bartlett. We're told and we're shown molest her from the age of 5 onwards. You also get Renee, who's Suki's co-worker's boyfriend, who is a vampire hater, but he's a fang, oh, what are they called?
Fang banger.
Fang banger hater. So he hates women, human women that sleep with vampires because it's a crime against humanity as such. So he
This is,
kills
of
and
course, sorry.
rapes women that sleep with vampires, including his sister, who he rapes and then rapes again once she's dead. So we've got incest, rape, and necrophilia all in the mix here.
Well, and bestiality, if
And
you, yeah.
bestiality. There's a lot going on.
There sure is. What there isn't going on, though, and to defend my cynicism a bit, they're not drinking animal blood, though, are they?
No. So,
So that's where I would say the difference with Twilight says we're vegetarian, but actually we're feeding on animals. True Blood says we're not vegetarian, but they are not, like, it's not equating drinking animal blood with not drinking human blood. Like, it sort of treats, even though it's by absence, like there aren't really non-human characters in the book apart from the dude who can turn into a dog. There aren't like animal characters, but it's not promoting feeding on other animals. Its alternatives are like, if you're feeding on blood, you're feeding on blood. There's not a good way to do it.
So they are what I and what Laura Wright, who's a vegan scholar, have termed vegan vampire. As Josh says, the vampires in this series do not feed on animals. They feed on either human blood taken from lovers or, forcefully taken from just, Jenny down the
Victims.
street.
Yeah. Wow. Watch out, Jenny.
But the synthetic blood, it makes them vegan insofar as synthetic blood has no biomaterial or genetic material. It's kind of, it's made in the laboratory. There's no species
Well, it just doesn't
implication.
come from an animal.
No, or a human.
Which is
So
an
it's
animal.
vegan. Yes, well.
Yes. So I think for me, even though like True Blood is showing that they're not living up to this ideal,
No.
the ideal itself is complete abstinence rather than just a transference that still draws a species line. But that
Yes.
also is by implication, by neglect, in that it doesn't engage with feeding on non-human animals. I mean, I'm sure there's probably lots of scenes of Sookie eating a steak or something, right? So I don't think it's promoting these things.
No,
But
it's pretty much a farce. It's completely lacks any sort of ethical, moral obligation. They don't do this due to care for humankind. They do it, as Josh said before, for personal or economic gain. They want money. They want to live like American capitalists. They want the neoliberalism that everyone else has.
And what's really interesting to me about True Blood, apart from just all the science fiction crap and the sex and the gore, is that, like, I think this is the closest to the Discworld model in that it's not this secretive, like, inter-vampire politics. This is a
No.
outward global political movement that is trying to integrate vampires into a broader society, which we talked about in the Discworld episode. Which it occurs to me now that Lady Margalotta, the vampire who starts the Temperance League in Discworld, is a beloved vampire because she is having an affair with the human patrician of Ankh-Morpork, Lord Vednari. Or if it's not sexual, it's like they are romantically involved. That is made explicit by the end of the series. So it's interesting that, yes, she is also a vampire lover. She's not a sympathetic vampire. She's a beloved vampire. But where they fall down is, like, she's not villainous. She's doing it for political control, but it is presented as for the betterment of society. Society is better off for her intervention, that vampires are better off being integrated into society, and society is better off for having them integrated. Whereas True Blood is coming down on the other side of that, saying that if you integrate vampires into society, they'll just keep wrecking it like they always have. And this is like the dilemma at the heart of the Discworld stuff, that the catchphrase that they throw out is, can the leopard change its shorts? And Discworld is saying yes, and True Blood is saying no. I think that is really interesting, and I say it all the time, but I really need to watch the rest of True Blood.
What I really find interesting about True Blood, and I said this before, was the difference between humans and vampires, and a lot of the backlash or the backpush against accepting vampires into American society is teased out along racial lines. So first of all, you've got, and many critics have made this point, I think the most eloquently is Ken Gelder, that you have this novel that's about rights, who has them, who doesn't have them, and it's set in Louisiana, which is where the Jim Crow laws were first brought into account. So there's a historical legacy of racism and racial mixing.
And the main vampire dude, Bill, like, was a Confederate soldier.
He was a Confederate soldier, which we also see in Vampire Diaries. That's something that someone needs to write an article about, the weird appearance of the Confederacy in vampires in the 21st century. But yeah, so in this series, that there's so much racial, or a real tension and discussion about race in this series. The opening credits, you see images of the Ku Klux Klan. You see the Westboro Baptist Church, which had the famous, or the infamous, I should say, sign outside the church that said "God hates fags" is rejigged to "God hates fangs" in this series. So kind of the hatred of vampires is really kind of meted out along hatred of Americans in particular. The TV series takes this further by also engaging with tension between what is it? I can't think of it now. But later in the series, when, and I think it, yeah, looking at it contextually and culturally, when there was a lot of discussion about illegal immigrants in America, particularly from Mexico, this series brings in a Mexican lover for one of the main characters. And there's a lot of colonial history touched out there. I'm doing a really bad job of explaining this.
That makes sense. That's really interesting with the, like, it's a primarily racial but also like minority analogy, because I was saying, like, with the Twilight stuff, if you try and hold a one-to-one analogy, it breaks down. And the same happens in True Blood, right? Because the vampires are an analogy for the disenfranchised, but then the end result is, well, actually, if you let them into the society, they're going to wreck it because they are inherently, like, genetically evil, I guess. Which was the same, like, pushback I had with some of the stuff in the Discworld series, where the only vampires who are allowed into the societies are the vampires that behave not like vampires. And of course, that runs up against, well, does behaving like a vampire mean eating people? I don't know. If you do the analogy to race, then what is behaving like a black person, behaving like a gay person? So these one-to-one analogies don't work, but, like, the overall suggestiveness, like, True Blood does seem to say that, well, and maybe it's being centrist and it's saying there are bad ones and good ones of everyone, and it's not a genetic thing, because there are the good vampires who are fighting against the evil government vampires that say that capitalism and government is bad. But I think if you take the broad view and you just look at it, the things vampires are being used to represent, like, it's also reinforcing the inherentness of them.
The other, so some other examples, or you end up with a Ku Klux Klan of sorts gets created in season four to fight the vampires. So there's, it's pretty bonkers how that all plays out. But the key thing for me in this series, if it goes back to, who has rights, who gets rights, who gets to decide who has rights and how you ask for it, the final shot of the series is this picture of Suki at a table with vampires, with witches, with did that really well,
Thank you.
with a menagerie of shapeshifters at her table. So it's this image of commensality, breaking bread with foes and friends and coming together through food. So again, the real interest here in food for our podcast. Yet the dinner that they're sitting to is a Thanksgiving dinner, which no one seems to have picked up on. And I don't know if that's because the majority of people that look at True Blood are American, so perhaps they're not, attuned
Well, I'm not
to
Native American.
exactly. So for a show that's all about rights and who has them, ends with this image of supernatural creatures celebrating the destruction and decimation and,
You don't think that was deliberate?
it is. And
Okay,
that's
cool.
the point that I think that everybody misses, is that the whole point of this series is pointing to, who doesn't have rights in America, that if, we're willing to extend, like we'd be more willing to extend rights to supernatural species that want to kill us than we are as a white society or majoritively white society.
Or just saying that, like, there is no perfect, like, someone is always getting fucked. Like, I don't know. I still have a discomfort with it, in that it's like, it's saying, oh, vampires will be fine if we let them into the society, but if we let them, Like they are the black people who are the victims of the Ku Klux Klan. But if you let them in the White House, everything will go to shit. And of course, this is coming out when Obama's in office, right? So the analogy again is suggesting that Obama has some kind of secret violent black agenda that is inherent to his race. It's like it's fucking weird when you try and make that analogy. But then we get to things like that Thanksgiving thing. I like that. That's cool. That's good.
I don't know. For me, it's just like, who has rights in America? Everyone but Native
Well,
Americans.
and that's
Because
the
then,
human social aspect. They're
exactly.
also, it's a turkey, I'm presuming, right?
That's been eaten at the table. I think you see Suki, I think she's pulling a turkey out of the oven,
Right.
and then you
So,
see her bring it to the table. So it's also, it would be animals.
to bring it
It's
back to
just,
the food thing.
it's just so interesting as a series, and I can never do it justice speaking about it because it's just so rich.
It also just sounds way more interesting to talk about than watch, because at least those first few series are excruciating when they're in the just vampire lover mode before they get to any of this political crap. It's just trash.
Worth noting, so episodes or seasons 1 to 3 follow books 1, 2, and 3 in the series. From season 4 onwards, the novels kind of fall out of the purview of the series, and it just starts going on itself, off its own accord.
Let's jump back then. What happens in the novels? Anything interesting? Because these predate Twilight, right? You said before the first one comes out in 2001.
So the Southern Vampire Mysteries, which True Blood is based on, were released between 2001 and 2013. And if anyone listening has not read the novels, do it. They are fun. Where True Blood is violent and gory and vile, these novels are clean, bouncy, romp-y fun. They're full of sex. They're full of, romance and mischief and magic. And they're all very cozy. A critic described them as, it creates this cozy world of humans and vampires living together in Louisiana. And I couldn't agree more. So the novels follow. And are narrated by Suki Stackhouse, who is our half human, half fae protagonist that works as a waitress at Merlot's Bar and Grill. And that's all true of True Blood as
Right, she
well.
works at a grill.
She works at a bar and
No, she
grill.
works
Yeah,
at a
so
grill.
you've got
Okay.
it centered in again. So here we're seeing just how integral food is to the world of vampire fiction, not only vampire dietary habits, but human dietary habits. Like, this is set pretty much in a restaurant, also in the South, where you have so many sociocultural habits and events and behaviors centered around food. And you see that also play out in the novels. A key difference of the novels to the TV series is that each novel is centered around some sort of supernatural mystery that Suki is wrangled in to solve. So things like someone's committing fraud in one of the vampire businesses. Another example is in books, I think 3 and 4, somebody's murdering shifters in the series. So humans that also can shift into birds, bats. Panthers. We get a lion in there as well, and they're just fun. But the novels are kind of, as we were saying in the previous discussion, where the TV series is really centered around race and uses race as a kind of model for understanding human vampire relations. Race is kind of swept to the side in the text. It's there, and again, read Ken Gelder's chapter on the Southern Vampire Mysteries. But it's not kind of at the forefront of the novels. The novels do a really shitty job of kind of explaining away and apologizing for any kind of racist undercurrent that you get. So they're entirely different. But again, in the novels, the development of synthetic blood allows vampires to come out of the coffin and join human society where they're largely accepted. The television series depicts a lot more tension between humans and vampires that kind of coalesces in government state-sanctioned murder. They kind of round up all the vampires in Louisiana and attempt to kill them in a jail, which has a lot of critics have argued there's really strong Holocaust imagery, which there is. The other thing the TV series does is it creates a second faction of vampires who follow what is it? It's like they follow the Book of Lilith, so a satanic Bible wherein vampires are, kings of the world, and it's their God-given right or Lilith-given right to feed on humans. Humans are
Right,
nothing
okay.
but cattle; they should be farmed, so on and so forth. And they blow up all the synthetic blood factories in order to force vampires into feeding on humans to create a civil war that will, throw their plan to gain civil rights to shit. In the series, that doesn't happen. In the series Vampire Rights Are Granted, Human Vampire Marriage is passed, things like universities start teaching special degrees in vampirism. You get vampire versions of fashion magazines like Vogue or People. There's vampire reality TV series. There's vampire police officers, which takes on that function of vampire slayers, Josh. You end up having vampires that take care of, criminal vampires. So it's a much more wholesome and a holistic interspecies world that we see in the mysteries where, vampires are pretty much fully accepted. Only in the tenth book or the 12th book?
One of them.
One of them, that's like following the success of vampire integration. And I use that term deliberately there. Like vampires are forced to kind of give up their vampire habits in order to become human. So again, it's almost a bribe that in order, if you want to be like us, you have to become us. The werewolves then go, oh, it went well for the vampires. So the werewolves then, throw their hat into the lot. And then you get some really problematic tensions where everyone in America hates werewolves. Werewolves are being racially profiled. They want to start a national register for werewolves so they can keep track of you. And those later novels pan out with, cultural events in America where there starts to be a little bit more fear over who is an American citizen. We need to keep track of you. It matches Obama's increasingly, what's the right word to use when he starts, prosecuting Snowden and using some really problematic legislation?
Authoritarianism.
Yeah. But yeah, the novels are like, in a word, they are really positive about the ability of synthetic blood to remake human vampire relations.
Right.
And so, it goes without really hitch in the novels versus the TV series where it all goes to shit.
Yeah, in the books, and I've read about half of them, or I've read one and then listened to podcast summaries of about four or five others. But
Yes, so good.
that well, they're goofy, they're weird, they're charming, but they're like they're
They're
not
so
well written.
charming. It's like the perfect beach book.
This is true. And we're burying the lead. Elvis is a vampire.
Oh,
He
yeah.
eats cats.
Elvis is a
Hang on.
vampire
Elvis
in
is a
this
vampire and
series.
he's relevant because he's harmless because he just eats cats. That is the one
He is
time where
our
we get
only
like
vegetarian vampire. If
non-human.
the others are, if we can, as I use the term vegan to classify the vampires that subsist on synthetic blood, Elvis or Bubba, as he's called in the novels, is our only vegetarian.
It does. It just says he eats cats, right? It doesn't imply that he's drinking from them. I think he eats them.
No, he drinks them because
Okay.
they find Bubba ends up being
The bodyguard.
a bodyguard for Sookie, and she finds like dead cats in
That's
the
right.
littered in the forest near her house. But the interesting thing, and thank you for reminding me of this. So in the series, as I've said, synthetic blood is used as kind of a promise and a bribe in equal terms to, allow vampires to come into human society and have their legal right. Nothing is really said about synthetic blood in the novels. Everyone drinks it from, Bill all the way up to vampire kings and queens. There's no dismissal of that diet.
What I was going to say before I got distracted by a cat eating Elvis vampire was that, like, in the books, it's just a premise. It's like it's basically just a narrative device to be, how do we have vampires in the society? And we solve the problem by saying they drink synthetic blood. And then it's no longer driving the plot. It's just an excuse for vampires to be there. Whereas,
Exactly.
yeah, in True Blood, it
Exactly.
becomes the center of the plot
Exactly.
itself.
And the vampires obviously are still feeding on humans as well as synthetic blood. But with Bubba feeding on, as I said, there's no dismissal or derision of this synthetic blood diet. But Bubba is kind of he's treated as the black sheep of the vampire community. They're embarrassed by his diet of animal blood. And they, like, their reason for it is that he was dying, or he'd taken a drug overdose and was dying as a human when he was then turned into a vampire by a vampire super fan that worked at the morgue. So
He's like brain dead.
he's kind of like brain dead or something when they turn him into a vampire, and that's how they excuse or apologize or account for his diet, which is interesting because in the other texts that we've looked at, there's no, apart from perhaps Anita Blake Vampire Hunter, where, animal blood diet.
Well, in Twilight, it's seen as the intelligent, enlightened way to live. And
Yeah.
then here, it's like, oh, you're a brain dead moron.
Yeah, here is there something actually wrong with you,
Okay.
and that's why you eat the way that you eat, and we're embarrassed by you, and we're going to hide you.
Yes, extremely interesting and I think extremely complex, like on par, if not surpassing the engagement with Discworld. And but those are the big ones, the big three, as you said, Twilight, Vampire Diaries, True Blood. But of course, there's been a million other ones. And why don't you run us through some of them?
So another kind of not T-Tex, but a really fun vampire television series of recent years is Discovery of Witches, starring Teresa Palmer and Matthew Good, who, my God, is fantastic. And I think he was born to be a vampire. And it's adapted from Deborah Harkness's historical fantasy series of the same name. And in this series, it kind of revolves around tensions between human, not humans, sorry, witches, vampires, and demons. So there's a species conflict, and the story follows a witch and a vampire who fall in love together, and then shit hits the fan because in this series, there's an ancient lore that says vampires, demons, and witches cannot mix. You've got to stay separate. Now, the vampire in this series, and this is of interest to us today, is he a vegetarian vampire? He does feed on animals, but he's also potentially an energy vampire because, and I found this really weird reading it, Matthew says he, like for him, he doesn't get his rocks off feeding on blood. He gets sustenance from the hunt. So there's a scene where like he hunts in front of his witch girlfriend and like for 3 hours is in like a hunting position. And then he's like, great, good meal. Let's go back home.
Yeah, no, I relate to this because I'm often hunting in front of my witch girlfriend. That's just, you know, what I do. Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought this up because I'm here desperately trying to work out, trying to remember what happened in Discovery of Witches, which is one of like 60 vampire books I've blasted through over the last 12 months. Because I was going to say the thing I remember about the book is the like he is a predator. That is his defining thing, that he and their romantic relationship is that he is like he's the dom and that she must submit to him because he is a natural predator. And it is constantly reiterated in the book that there is a natural dominance that oozes from him as his position as the alpha predator that forces her or encourages her to submit to. Now, she's happy to go along with this, but again, like with Kindred and stuff, it's like, well, how much of it is consensual?
She doesn't though, because he, she also, she's quite defiant of him. And it's that classic, you're right, there is a lot where he says to her, he's like, you know, vampires are naturally controlling by nature. I'm going to be very controlling. And she does, you
Like
know.
she resists it, but she accepts that as a premise. She
You're
does
right,
the
he
like,
is.
she puts up with it rather than being like, you're a jerk and you shouldn't be like this. Like it's a
But
lot of
it
the.
gives off its strong Twilight vibes.
Oh, yeah,
And
because
keeping in
Twilight is
mind,
a story about domestic abuse and child grooming. Yes.
exactly. And Discovery of Witches, the novel was first published in 2011, and Twilight, the novel, was 2005. So you can see that kind of controlling vampire boyfriend archetype.
But I don't think in Discovery of Witches, which I did overall, I mean, I don't remember any details about it, but I remember really like enjoying it as a book and a story. But that central relationship, like, I don't think it ever grapples with this stuff. Because I was about to say,
No.
like, this is Butler. This is, but Kindred is deliberately presenting these complex things and trying to work them out. And this is very reminiscent of the Survivor, the Butler book I'm working at the moment that she disowned. That is about a human lady who falls in love with a hairy alien man who is inherently violent and beats and rapes her, but she apologizes. Apologizes for him and things, and falls
Shit.
in love. Yeah, this is what Butler's books are about. But again, she is not. It's more complex. It's more problematized than in Discovery of Witches. She's just like, well, that's the way he is.
It's again, I think it's because in the novels, this protective instinct is what's what I'm looking for. It's explained as a byproduct of love. So the more you love someone, the more protective you are. It's a natural instinct for the vampire, which I think tries to naturalize and rationalize that protective instinct because you're like, well, you know, it's part of their nature as a vampire. I think it's also, and I know this is problematic, but there's
Word of the
something.
episode.
There's something like erotic about
Mean, insofar
that
as it's part of
dominance.
this tradition, like it is presented as he is a book about a sexy witch vampire relationship. But me, who does not respond to any of this sort of stuff, I just read it and went, this is like, this is fucked. I was the devil versus witches stories, I was much more interested in. But yeah, the other thing was going back to the like hunting in front of my witch girlfriend thing is that, yeah, it's also implied that he is invigorated by the hunting process itself, that he feeds on being a predator, which.
Would you not say that's energy vampire? Like, because you're then feeding on.
I don't know if it's like that explicit. Like, I don't know.
Because
Yeah.
he does feed on animals, like,
As
but for
well.
him, like, so that he does, hunt and then eventually does kill and then drink the blood. But you're right, he's more invigorated by
I'd have to
the
go
hunt.
back to the book and like actually find the passages. But like, for me, this just plays into the idea that like of meat and hunting being empowering and things like that. Like, it's a Neo-Carnist thing that is connected to domestic abuse and then portrayed as a positive, desirable romantic relationship. It's pretty fucked
The other
for
thing worth mentioning is they
yeah.
also eat raw food in this text. So
Okay.
similar to Discworld, where there's the raw meat eating. If I'm not mistaken, it was Discworld.
They worked at the slaughterhouse and they drank the kosher blood.
Or
Oh, that
was
was
it
Kindred. Kindred, they ate the raw meat.
yes,
Yeah.
the meat beast.
Oh, that was Vampire Hunter D.
That was
But that
Vampire
was
Hunter D.
humans were eating the meat beast. The
Oh,
vampires
humans eating the
genetically
meat beast.
engineered
I'm
the
guessing
meat beast.
all the
The
meat and then the
vampires drank the synthetic blood.
Right. So they also
Come on,
eat
Sophie,
raw
get it
meat in this
straight.
series. So they can eat raw meat, raw nuts, and berries. And obviously the link between all those elements is it's raw food.
Right.
So maybe hunting, gathering, again, back to a natural style of living.
When there's something there, and that Percy Shelley's whole thing was that Prometheus, it was all Prometheus' fault because he let us, like, we couldn't eat flesh until we could cook it. So,
Well, it's the Frankenstein diet.
yes.
Creature loves nuts. He loves berries.
He doesn't
He
like
just
raw meat
wants to be
though, because he eats
loved.
the offal and he spits it out. He wants to be
Ew.
loved to the point that he murders a child to prove a
Yeah.
point. It's like, the monster's not a good dude, guys. I know everyone went ham and got all sympathetic.
Creature is divine, and Frankenstein is the monster, and
Frankenstein's
that's
an
that.
asshole, but that
Oh,
doesn't
he's
make
a.
the creature a good dude.
No, Creature's a good dude. He's a victim of circumstance.
A body count?
Killers are made, not born.
So all killers, they're fine.
It's their parents that, we should be really
I don't know.
getting angry
I
at.
think people really wanted to do the it's the creature's the victim reading when they like,
No.
Frankenstein got reevaluated
I
in the mid
love
20th century and
Creature's a vegetarian.
he is. I
He's
wrote a thesis about this. I'm
I
well
know you
aware.
did. I know you did. He's inherently good and then he's made evil because people think he's ugly. And that really upsets him.
It definitely upsets him. I'm not saying people were nice to him. I don't think you have to
His
murder a
only friend
child.
was a blind man.
So therefore, you should kill a child.
No, he saves the child in the
No,
book. He kills the child in the
he doesn't.
movie. Yeah, he saves her from drowning and then her father shoots her. Him.
Yeah, that happens. And then he meets William,
Oh, yeah,
Frankenstein's
he
younger
kills
brother,
William, but
and he
William's a
strangles him to
little.
death.
Oh, I would
William's just a
too.
dude.
William's a
He's
little
just walking
shit.
around.
Shit of a kid.
He's just a kid walking around. Kills her, then frames the servant for the murder and gets her
Yeah,
executed.
he kills, he kills William, blackmails Justine, and then does he kill Justine or is she put to the death?
Justine is executed for his
Yeah,
crimes.
she's executed.
He then kills Clevel and he kills the
Kill Clevel.
yeah he
Fuck,
kills
I haven't.
Clevel and he kills the wife, obviously
Yep.
Elizabeth. Tears his wife in half on
I
his
reckon
wedding
that's a
night.
mercy. Imagine being married off to fucking Victor Frankenstein. I'd rather be dead.
He kills yeah kills all those people. Yeah,
Go, creature.
great
Body
guy,
count.
very sympathetic. He's Cain. I've got it. This is in my book. Read my book. He's not Satan. He's Cain, and he fucking sucks. Let's get
Moving
back.
on.
Yeah, we're okay. So we were on. That's Discovery, which is it's weird. The
It's
other one,
fantastic.
it's like that's the thing. I did think as a book it was pretty good, but the ethics there are pretty messed up.
Surely as an academic, it sucks you in.
Oh, I don't know. I'm stuck on. I've got like 10 more vampire like books that I want to read, and I have
Send
been.
me the list so I can
Ooh,
read them too. I'm running
and.
out of books.
I am stuck on, like, there's a few that I've started that have stumped me, and I am stuck on The Historian, which I'll grab it. Look, I'm staring at it, it's up here, and I don't physically read it. I listen to this as an audiobook, so, but this is The Historian, award-winning early 2000s vampire novel.
I
It
love you
is
can always tell it's a vampire novel if
this
there's
big,
blood. Oh.
and it's so dry. So this is 700 pages. It's a historian. It's about a historian doing. It's a fucking Vlad Tepes book, which that's my least favorite vampire trope. So it's
Lame,
a
I don't want to read it
historian,
anymore.
yeah. And it's just sucking my will to live reading historical academic.
Book's a
The book is an
vampire.
energy vampire, yeah.
Yeah.
So that is one of the few that has just wrecked me because I'm like, yeah, reading about someone doing research, especially when you're trying to do research about it, is fuck God. does my head in. I guess the other big vampire TV show, there's Being Human as well. Do we have anything to say about that other than that's another TV show where vampires and werewolves and things are part of society and they don't drink human blood? That's just another
Yeah,
example,
that's
right?
just it. And it occurs the same time as the big three.
Yeah. The other one that we wanted to talk a bit about, because you've written an article about it and it's one of my favorite vampire books, is V Wars from 2019 is the series. You've
Well, I'll preface this by saying I haven't read the
And
books
I haven't watched the series, so
because they sound shit. I'm not interested in an eyewitness account narrative. That just
that's
pisses
not
me
what it
off.
is.
That's what the blurb said.
The blurb sucks. So the book is short stories about, they're just like, they're not just short stories, like they're chapters of short stories. So there are like three or four major narratives that are like threaded throughout the thing that are all like different perspectives. And it's just like, what if vampires were part of the world? Like it's the
Yeah.
True Blood thing where vampires have a political party and like there's a vampire running for office is one of the stories.
Are
But it
they
is,
Bloods in the series as well?
are they what?
What's their name in the books?
Vampires. Well, the thing is
Oh.
that I think it's like a mutant thing where they all start genetically, or they like latent vampires awaken. But the thing is that like it's cultural, so people from different cultural backgrounds evolve into the vampires that they are representative of. So there's like weird Asian vampires and thing, like the hopping vampire is one of them. So it is just stories of like
Wow.
what happened if vampires were in the world, and like, yeah, what is interesting to me about, they're not just like, oh, here's a horror story about a vampire. It's like a lot about societal stuff. Like there is a main character who runs through the stories who is like the first vampire to hold office and things like that. It's and the so the stories are written by different authors. But yeah, it's just like a narrative about a world and vampires in them, and I think it's very good. I haven't read the sequels, but the book itself is very good.
Wow. From what you've said, the TV series is so different. So it was released in 2019. It was adapted and executive produced by Ian Somerhalder for my Vampire Diaries diehard fans. He played Damon. It's one of the vampire series for him. And my interest in it really is because not only do you have the dietary ethics, synthetic blood comes into it in the piece, and I'll discuss that in a moment, but the series is entrenched in climate catastrophe. In the series, the vampire virus or vampirism occurs due to ice melt in the Arctic, which releases previously frozen animal material and human bones that have the vampire disease within them. So not unlike the spread of anthrax in Russia due to the ice melt. So you've got a scientific background to this virus that's grounded in, ice melt, ecological catastrophe. And then the series tracks it spread throughout America. And it's quite epidemiological in its kind of how it tracks how this virus is spread. It's spread through pathogens that can exist on the surface of tables. It's spread through saliva. It's also airborne. A lot of COVID echoes, you could say. As I was writing the article during lockdown, I was like, shit, this takes on a whole new lens when seen through COVID-19. So the virus spreads, America goes to the shit, and then this series gets really off track because it tries to incorporate every type of vampire trope imaginable. There's the use of the military to combat this. It's also attacked from a scientific point of view. So you have like techno scientific labs. You then also have a like the dietary component where vampires become this big group that want civil rights, not unlike True Blood. And then the government responds by creating their own type of synthetic blood called Blood Sub. Within that, you then get a faction of vampires that do not want to live alongside humans and say, screw you, you're killing vampires, trying to eradicate us. We want to eradicate you in turn. So the final episode of the series ends in this human vampire war, and you get the first stirrings of a civil war. It's quite apocalyptic in its imagery. Buildings have burnt down. You can imagine the White House has been bombed. That sort of post-apocalyptic stirrings that you see. So we've got so much happening in this series. It's a dog's breakfast to watch. But for me, I find it really interesting due to the vampirism's origin in climate catastrophe, and also then the appearance of synthetic blood as an attempt to bring peace and to stop civil war. So again, the dietary aspect comes in.
Yeah, I'm just looking through my notes that I took from the book, and it doesn't seem like there's, I've got like, are there other vegetarian vampires? Question mark. So I think that there is like perhaps a reference to like vampires, but none of the actual characters we see in the book are, according to my notes, I don't remember it very well. There's something about there being talking about milking the human blood cows and then comparisons between humans and cows. So I think
Interesting.
it's gesturing towards that stuff, but not necessarily engaging with it. I don't remember there being synthetic blood in the book, but there might have
No.
been, but I don't
I
remember
think the TV series, and again, saying this having not read any of the novels,
it.
I think the TV series really departs quite drastically.
Right.
And it's, I cannot understate how shit the television series is. It's the worst thing I think I've ever watched, keeping in mind Vampire Academy, which is also so bad. The TV series, not the books. The books are amazing. My second favorite vampire series.
The book of which books?
Vampire Academy.
Oh yes, yeah. Okay, so this is does Vampire Academy. We've already talked about this on the previous episode, so I don't
Did
think we
we?
need. Yeah. We had a whole thing because we were talking about subtext about how they're lesbians, and you're like, no, they're not. I'm like,
Oh
they definitely
yeah,
are.
I hate that reading.
It's there.
I
It's so like that's not just me. That is
cannot.
so like this is queer bait to the max. What is there anything like vegetarian stuff in Vampire Diaries that we want to highlight here?
You mean Vampire
Vampire
Academy?
Academy. Yeah.
We would have said this last time, but again, the vegetarian thing in my conceptualization of the term vegetarian is that the good vampires in this series feed on donated human blood. They have feeders who sit in a cafeteria-esque hospital room, and the vampire students make appointments to come and suck their blood. So there's no killing.
Right.
If you kill a human and drink all their blood, then you turn into one of the evil vampires, the Strigoi, who then feed on vampire blood, like good vampire blood. You're right. The novels are more interested in the politics of vampire royalty. They're also interested in love and romance, and yes, it's more interested in that the Moroi versus Dampier conflict. Not a lot to do with diet, other than it's what makes you good or evil.
Gonna say I'm not sure where like I fall on voluntary feeding. Like I think I know the idea itself I think is better than drinking from animals and killing them. But in terms of like where I classify it, like they're not vegetarian because they're in either sense of the word because they're not doing the thing. And like if I want to replace vegetarian with human abstinent, then they're definitively not. So we run up with the reverse problem. So I think it is that is a beside behind synthetic blood. I'm probably saying that is the best way for vampires to actually feed, but I don't think it falls on like it's not an abstinence, right? It's a different
No, but it's
arrangement.
still ethical insofar as they're not hurting humans, and it's a voluntary choice by the humans. But the novels do say, it's their so the reason why humans volunteer for this is because they're drug addicts,
Right.
and the vampire bite releases like endorphins that make them really happy and high.
Yeah, I just remembered another thing I want to say about the Darren Shan series is that the good vampires and they have a vampire mountain that's this hollowed out mountain. That's where the vampire council and the vampire princes and everything live. And they are waited on by an underclass of I can't remember what they are, but they're like weird dudes. And they are voluntary like donors that are this underclass of the vampires, and they're like presented as no, we serve, and then maybe one day they get turned into vampires or something. I can't remember, but there's like something going on with them, but they are the underclass. They serve the vampires. So the vampires feed on the volunteers who also wait on them hand and foot. Like it's not equality. Oh no, are they? They might be weird dudes from the future who regenerate or something. This series goes places.
It does go places.
It does. There's yeah, the last trilogy is like a parallel world time travel novel. It's because there's an evil wizard man who is the brother of the artificial humans who run the circus. It's fucking wild, but reads like a 12-year-old wrote it, not only just read it. So that is Vampire Academy. Do we have any other TV series and things that we want to highlight?
Firebite.
Oh yeah, okay, go on.
So a recent, very, very recent Australian vampire series, Firebite, also includes there's a singular vampire who feeds on blood bags.
Right.
Now, this series is interesting, not really for the dietary, I guess, yes, in terms of dietary, but it's more interesting because it's a First Nations series that features a First Nations vampire hunter who uses like boomerangs to decapitate vampires, and there's like this Australian rock soundtrack that's just so refreshing. It's like Mad Max had a like a vampire Mad Max would be the best way of describing this series. And it's produced by AMC, who are the people behind The Walking Dead. So that's all I really need to say for you to go and watch it. What's cool about this series, and I'm not using cool in like cool meaning good, because it's definitely not good, but in this series, vampires are
Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer.
disclaimer, huge disclaimer. Vampires in this series are also, what's the way of saying this? So vampires in this series are introduced to Australian soil with the First Fleet. So this story is kind of a historical reimagining of the colonization and invasion of Australia. And in lieu of the historical narrative that the British brought over smallpox with them to decimate First Nations people and thus accelerate the invasion and settling of Australia, they brought over vampires with them. And so vampires in this series are related to those settlers, invaders, Captain Cook, and they all wear kind of, military regalia that are all tattered from centuries being here, or over just a century, I should say. And in this series, with the background of how they came to Australia and why, vampires feed exclusively on, and a quote from the show is, blackfella blood. So they're addicted to and feed only on First Nations blood. So you see some really visually jarring examples of these just white, pasty vampires just killing and feeding on black bodies. And it's, like, I don't even need to explain how it is an analogy or metaphor for,
It's
current day
not that subtle.
Australia. It's not subtle. But you do have in this series, there's one vampire who befriends, works at a bar. It's set in Coober Pedy. It's really freaking cool. And yeah, she's the one vampire who feeds on synthetic blood. I don't think that's significant, but there is a, within this series, there is
Yeah.
a
Well,
vegetarian
yeah,
vampire.
now it's sort of like, I think this is a good example because it's sort of obligatory now. We've got to the
Yeah.
point with the vampire thing that if you don't have a vegetarian meat bag,
Yeah.
that's Mad Max. No, Mad Max, they have the blood bags. That's interesting.
They've also got the milk.
The milk.
Yeah. The most recent one that's really shit. They like drink milk,
The most
mother's
recent one
milk.
that's really shit. You mean the really good one?
I don't like Mad Max, but
No, but
Mad Max.
Fury Road was fucking sick though. But the Mad Max is the blood bag because the guy has the blood transfusion. They have the humans who are the.
I've only seen that last one and I was half
This is
asleep for
the
most of
last
it.
one. This
It's
is the
shit.
start of the last one. Are you talking about Fury Road with the guy with the guitar and the human
Yeah.
fire?
I watched it
That
purely
movie's so
to see if
fucking
Rosie
good.
Huntington-Whiteley could act. And she was just pregnant the entire time, so
She
no.
was. Yeah, but then she fucking shoots someone in the face at the end and it rules. That movie's great and you are wrong and you need to rewatch it.
Oh,
But no,
thank
Mad
you.
Max, the premise of why Mad Max is in the car in that movie is he is the main guy has like cancer or some shit and he is running his blood through Max in the car because otherwise he's going to have to sit the battle out. So he has a tube that connects that is pumping Mad Max's blood through him, which is like,
I didn't
that's
even
kind
pick
of,
up on that if that's actually what
you
happened.
need to rewatch this movie.
No, thank you. I've got enough work to do.
And I need to watch Firebite.
It's so good.
Yeah, that's the modern popular beloved vampire trend that we're still in. Which that just sort of goes to show like how prevalent and essential this vampire trend, this vegetarian vampire concept is to the modern portrayal and image of the vampire. But those are all TV series and adaptations of books that came before Twilight. I don't know, like there hasn't really been anything significant since.
No, I wouldn't say so.
So I guess at the end, I just wanted to point out a couple of examples of vegetarians who become vampires, right? Which is surprisingly rare, given that it seems like a pretty easy moral conundrum to set up. But I only have three examples of where this happens. One is from the book Sunshine, which is very good. That's my 11th favorite vampire book. After V Wars, One Below V Wars. We are getting to like almost a year since I've read some of these. Robert McKinley's Sunshine, published in 2003, so not post Twilight, but this is one that you always see showing up on lists of like underrated vampires novels and things. I remember it being very good. What happened with it? There was a lady, she's a vegetarian, she gets kidnapped and becomes like this symbiotic servant to a vampire. There's voodoo wars. I don't remember why this book was interesting, but it was, and she's a vegetarian in it. Also, surprisingly, The Lost Boys 2, which is an incredibly good movie. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen either of them, no.
Have you you seen either Point Break or the first Fast and Furious movie?
No.
You haven't seen either of those.
No.
Okay, well, Lost Boys 2 is literally just Point Break, but what if instead of drug dealers they were vampires? So Point Break is the movie where Keanu Reeves goes undercover to investigate a drug cartel who are extreme sports guys. They're like surfers, they're surfer bros who also jump out of planes and things. And the first Fast and Furious movie is just what if Point Break, but instead of surfers they were like drag race car drivers, street racers. And then Lost Boys 2, which again is just very good, just a very good movie. It's just straight up Point Break, but what if they were vampires and like they're still surfers? So it's good. But the girl in that who gets turned into a vampire, she is a vegetarian. And the last and perhaps most significant example is the dude from City of Bone. Was he?
Yes.
Yes, he's a vegetarian and a Jewish vegetarian who they notably they feed by getting blood from the kosher butcher, which I think is the only place I've seen that outside of Discworld. It is interesting now that I think about it. Why is there a kosher butcher in Discworld when there aren't Jews?
I know.
What's going on there?
There must be. Like, why else have a kosher butcher?
There are religions, like there is a Christian like analogy that is omniism, but I don't think there are Jews. Intriguing. I'll have to think about that one. So I just wanted to point those out. That's just another thing I've observed, but surprisingly rare, to use a meat pun. Okay, we've now done, I think, in total about 12 hours of vegetarian vampire recording, which once I take out all the silences and the 40-minute FBoy Island asides, we'll edit down to probably around 2.5 hours per episode. But
I think we keep the F Boy Island stuff in.
oh no, that will be published as a bonus. You got to pay for that.
Oh.
If you go to patreon.com/unseenacademicals and sign up for any amount of money, I think the lowest one's like $6 Australian. So if you're in the UK or the US, that's like $3, and you get all the bonus episodes I've done. So that can be the one for this. You can get our FBoy Island recommendation and update. But yeah, that's we just wanted to get this out of our system. But also we're gonna put this in a book or some shit.
Yep, something.
Well, thanks for doing that with me, Sophie.
that's all right that was fun.
And we're clear.
One thing that's really struck me with the Love at Stake novels, from I'd say probably, at least from my knowledge, from Anita Blake onwards, there seems to be a real movement to vampires are part of the human world. There's growing interactions between the two. Those interactions are largely later down the track facilitated by and maintained by the shift in diet. Yet in Love at Stake, it is based on the creation of synthetic blood, yet the distance is maintained between the vampire and human worlds. Each vampire in every book ends up coupling up with a human, but the human ends up being taken out of their world and becomes a part of the vampire world. Like the novels are, it's very separate.
Right.
There's no integration.
Okay, that is very interesting.
That could be changing in the book I'm reading now, where vampires are working with the US government, which sounds really bonkers.
Isn't that
So
where True Blood ends up going as well? Or they just become the government or something? I've seen bits and parts of the final season and
no, I
like they
think
were in the White House.
the government goes against vampires. So it's the Louisiana governor tries to go. He does a bit of a Hitler on them and launches a final solution.
But that sounds very interesting, and now I have to read it because I wasn't going to, because it's called Love at Stake and the first book is called How to Marry a Millionaire Vampire.
Yeah,
But now you tell me it's
it's.
actually interesting though.
Well, I find it really interesting,
Oh, there's
but
16 of them.
they're repetitive. So I'm on what one am I on?
Hang on. Let's look at some of these titles. The most recent one is called Crouching Tiger, Forbidden Vampire.
I know, it's a bit stupid. I'm on Sexiest Vampire Alive, which I think is number 9 or
Which is two
10.
books before, three books
Oh,
before
no.
Vampires Gone Wild.
I finished that book last night, so I'm on a new one now. Yeah, they're pretty stupid. What's
Eat, Pray,
irritating about
Love,
these
which isn't even
books?
a pun with prey. It's
No,
just Eat, Pray,
so
Love.
that's the first novel where it stops being vampire human, it becomes a werepanther human.
Oh, yeah,
And then the
as you
book
do.
after that becomes a vampire angel, and now we're back to vampire human. So the
Sexiest
world,
vampire alive and human.
yeah. Oh no, there was a vampire werewolf one before the werepanther one.
Hang on, I'm not. I know you're trying to get to a point, but I've just seen All I Want for
No.
Christmas is a Vampire.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
How long are these?
No.
I hope they're very short.
The ebook version is maybe how many? Well, it says it's like 600 pages, but it's
Yeah, but
Like,
that's
I'm
intense
smashing
stuff.
these out in the course of 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, okay. So quite
But
short.
with that said, I'm skipping over all the sex because
Yep.
all these vampires seem to have a really intense chip on their shoulder about pleasuring women before they can reach pleasure themselves. And it's always just like fellatio or cunnilingus, if we're using the correct term there. And in every, it always starts with like the nipples pebbling. And I really don't like the descriptor of pebbling because
Pebbling's
it's,
not great, though.
I wouldn't say it looks, it's just wrong. And it's repeated, like that pebbling is repeated throughout every single damn book. And it's just like, come on, like I think we can stop copying and pasting sex scenes and just changing who's in it. The last book I read ended on levitating vampire sex on the ceiling.
Well, I mean, that's classic.
And I was like, great. This sounds a
No,
bit like
I
Scary Movie, but
sympathize
sure.
because I've been one of my high school students that I'm tutoring is doing The Dressmaker at the moment. Have you read The
Oh,
Dressmaker?
God.
Which I was surprised to discover is all about football and nipples. The word nipples, apparently there's only six instances
Football
in
and
the whole
nipples.
book, but the word nipples, every time I go to a quote, the word nipples is part of the paragraph. It's a whole thing. So that's been amusing. And then we got very hung up in our last session, or I got hung up on the description of there was a sex scene where he put her beige areola in his mouth. And I was like, do they come in beige?
Yeah, they come in
They
beige.
come in beige? Aren't they
They
normally
come in
like
all sorts of
not
colors.
beige? Yeah, but they're normally like.
But why areola?
Well, I don't know. It was just in the book, but I was like, a beige areola. Okay. All right.
You know, because you get like really light nipples to all the way to like really dark nipples. Same with men. You'll see some dudes with like really dark brown nipples.
Beige. I don't know. I've never encountered a beige nipple,
A
but.
beige nipple, it's quite, I like beige as a word. Beige. Beige nipple. It sounds like a real
Or a beige
fancy nipple.
areola.
Yeah, I don't like the use of the term areola there. But yeah, this fascination with fucking pebbling nipples. I got to like the third book and I was like, I swear to God, I'm so sick of these sex scenes. But it's interesting because they have, it's a whole vampire world. So it's, you've got the inventor of synthetic blood who runs a whole science industry, and fusion cuisine. So you end up with like Blia, which is beer and blood, Blisky, which is blood and whiskey,
Okay.
Choco blood, which speaks for itself, Blardinet. What was the other blood fusion drink? And so they get like blind drunk on these fusion drinks, but there's a secret service of vampires, but they're all Scottish vampires turned around the Battle of Culloden. So what, 1500s? And they run around wearing kilts and they've all got big throbbing cocks that, you end up seeing underneath these kilts. It's a very, it's a unique series while at the same time rehashing a lot of tropes. But it's an interesting take on it. I like Scottish vampires. It's like they need to make an Outlander where they all become vampires.
Well, it sounds like they have.
They have.
No, but I mean, what's interesting there to me is it's, as you said, it's the human becoming part of the vampire world rather than the humans. So yeah, keep us posted on that. Yeah, we can probably I will cut all of that and we can put it in the place where this goes because that ended up being a
Let's get rid of the big throbbing cock, though, and
oh no,
the
that
nipples.
the cock stays, the cock's gold.